The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Very excited for my next guest. I read his work. I suggest you as well go to winesinniagara.com is the website. It is founder, writer, and it's Rick Van Sickle. Rick, thanks so much for joining the show.
Oh, happy to be here, Matt. Interesting people. Okay, I'll take it. I hope I live up to it. And I have to say, following Matt O'Brien, oh boy, I better get my funny going here.
You know what? Here's the thing. Never try. Matt O'Brien is funnier than both of us combined. And hey, thanks for listening. Yeah, he was, if you missed it, last podcast with comedian Matt O'Brien, who has the funniest wine reviews going in Twitter and really on the internet. But see, what I like about this podcast is I just do a whole lot of range. With Matt, it was kind of making fun of the wine industry. But with you, Rick, I want to talk all about Niagara. You wrote a piece on how 2020, that year outside of wine, will be remembered for 1,000 negatives. But on the positive, Niagara had an incredible, incredible vintage. And you know what? I want to also talk about your background and all that. But let's just start with 2020. What were the specific conditions that happened that made this past year so good for wine growing, both red and white?
Well, Matt, as you know, Niagara and the new world, of course, there are no limits on what you can grow in a new world. It's not like the old world where Burgundy, it's Chardonnay and Pinot and Bordeaux. It's, generally bold red varieties. In Niagara and BC or anywhere in the new world, you can grow whatever you want. There are no limits. There are no rules. So in Niagara, they grow the Bordeaux varietals. They grow the Burgundy varietals. They grow Riesling. They grow Gamay. So every vintage, no matter if it's warm or cold, will have some stellar wines, either the whites are fresh and finessed and wonderful, and the Bordeaux varietals are, somewhat less ripe. You still have something there that you can enjoy. In 2020, the conditions were such that this rarely happens. I don't think it's happened like this ever, not since I've been covering Ontario wine and not since I've been doing vintage charts all the way back to 1998 and drinking many wines beyond that and tasting them. And from the winemakers themselves, the veterans say they've never seen one like 2020, where you not only got late ripening, perfect phenolics through all the varieties, but also there was some freshness at the end. There was enough kind of cooling down and then warming up to make the whites. The whites are generally need that finesse that were I don't know if perfect's the right word, but beautiful whites and beautiful reds. And everything was picked on cue. In other words, usually in a vintage, Mother Nature dictates when you pick. Let's say you have a week of rain coming, you're going to get out there and you got to make a decision. Am I going to pick Pinot today, or am I going to pick Chardonnay? One's going to be better than the other. What am I getting before the rain come? So you go, you pick your pea, and then the Chardonnays end up can be a little suspect. In this, it was everything came in on cue, and it was a relaxing one grape after another till everything was in the house, and nothing dramatic happened other than lower yields, which might not be too bad in a year like 2020.
All right, there's a lot there I want to unpack about everything you just said, but I want to go to one of the last words you used there, relaxing. How often when you talk to winemakers do you get it? Because to me, that's a word I rarely hear. That must be an incredible year, because I don't think of relax or relaxing when I think of winemaking.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there have been, you know, living here in Niagara, I try to get out there and see the vintage unfolding for myself so that I can write a better report on it. And I talk to them as I go. In 2020, I wasn't out there as much, but I went to a few places where, you know, I stood back and wasn't as close to the action as I usually am. But they were just calm, cool, and collected. A year like last year, for example, it was sheer panic. You know, they didn't know what to do. They were picking grapes in 2019 in December. The ice wine harvest was already in. They're still picking Cabernet.
Really?
You can see trucks full of Cabernet Sauvignon, you know, among the Christmas lights being hung out there. I mean, it was, you know, that's panic. The year before it was picking between rains, 2018, picking between rains and sacrificing one varietal over another. You could go to Bench Brewing, and if a winemaker, you know, caught 10 minutes, they're having it like they're pouring back beers at Bench Brewing going, oh my God, what's coming next? You know, it's like sheer panic. 2020 was just like, oh my God, what is going on here? You know, it's just an incredible vintage that way.
Getting back to vintage, actually, could you explain one thing to people that might not know? I'm sure a lot of the listeners know, but a lot don't. What is it about rain in the fall, rain near harvest, that can destroy a wine and stresses out winemakers to no end?
Well, you know, simply rain dilutes grapes. And if you can't dry them out before they get to the crush pad, you're just adding water to the mix that you don't want. So it, you know, unconcentrates the grapes and makes them, you know, less attractive for making wine. Now, if the rain is constant, you have a problem. You either get it before it rains, or at some point you're going to have to go in and get those grapes. And can you dry them out? And you know, it's near impossible to dry them out completely. So you want nice dry grapes coming into the crush pad, so your grapes aren't diluted. That's simply what it means. It also stunts the phenolic growth of the grapes.
One thing I read in your piece was that I found interesting was that this was a vintage that could work for Cabernet Sauvignon, but could also work for Riesling. And is that just the case of you get the heat in the summer and the early fall, but the nights get cool enough, sort of like wine conditions in Spain? Is that really the big key, is where both grapes get served, they just get served at different points of the day?
By the time fall came around and it came time for Riesling or the tender varieties, there was enough cooling at night and enough little periods of rain. Like, it didn't rain a lot, but it did come at the right time. So your vines weren't getting stressed. You'd get a downpour and then another week of warm weather, cooler nights. So everything was on schedule. Like, if your optimum picking is when your bricks are at a certain, you know, the sugar ripeness is at a certain point, and it hit all those numbers all the way along. So what was good for the early ripening was good for the late ripening. It just was in a succession that was perfect.
Yeah. A lot of places to go from here. How, and I, actually, well, let's go to COVID for a second. You mentioned that this past year you were, that you weren't really on the vines in the vineyards as much as you usually were. Is that because of just COVID and COVID restrictions?
Yeah, for sure. I respected, like, harvest crews were in a bubble. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in their bubble.
Right.
So I wasn't about to be on the crush pad and taking pictures and talking to winemakers or talking to them as I usually do, or just popping in. Like, I'll just drive around Niagara in my car and pop in. If I see people on the crush pad or picking, I will just stop it. I know most of these people, so I'm welcome to at least the places that I'm familiar with. I couldn't do that this year. I did a bit at invitation only at Vineland and places like Ravine, winemakers that I've good contact with. So it was different. You know, all the pictures that I had to use for the piece were taken by the various wineries themselves and not by me. And you know, I think the reports that they submitted to me were outstanding, like really, really great reports. Now it helps that you have a a good vintage, but over the years, I've been doing these reports for about 12 years, and it started out horrible. You know, I would just get this, you know, like bullshit.
Yeah.
Be like, as I don't know, Sandra Oldfield sent me a note saying, don't winemakers say this is the vintage of the century every year?
Well, that's where I was going to next is, like, what would be if people read this piece and your articles are great, and not just this one, but ones in the past, like you're very good with the pictures. And I think that's great for wine learning because it paints the picture, excuse me for using picture twice. I have better words here. But I think it really helps to put someone who wants to learn about wine, it helps put them in the location. So I think the pictures are great, but what's your pushback when someone says, winemakers, every year is the greatest year. Every year is 2015 Bordeaux.
Yeah, what you mean? What's the pushback for me?
Yeah, what's the pushback for you when someone is suspicious when you proclaim all the winemakers said 2020 was so good?
You know what? It's not an open invitation to get these reports from winemakers. It's just not. The ones who I'm not gonna name names, but
of course,
if you're using your marketing team to write your vintage report, I'm just not going back to you. Right? Mm. I'm not letting the marketing people, because essentially I guarantee that I will edit these comments and I will cull from it an overall point of view, and I'll write a long intro of what I saw and things that they said. I'm not going to use them again. I'm not going to go back to them. They insist on using a marketing department to write the reports because it sounds like it. And mm-hmm. it sounds bullshitty, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't, but it sounds bullshitty. I need authentic comments. And I think they've learned over time that it's their benefit to be perfectly honest about the harvest. Now, if they want to stress the high points and de-stress the low points, that's fine. I can call from that. In Niagara, as I said in the beginning, there are good things in almost every vintage. I can't think of a roundly terrible vintage unless you go back to the Winterkill years, and that was primarily because the vines were wiped out due to cold over the winter. But there's always something good that you can concentrate on. And I think that's in the body of the text that I write, that what are the good points and here are the things to avoid.
What are the tells? And for the listeners, how, you know, your vintage charts go back to the, I think, 90s at 96. I know it's somewhere in the mid to late
98.
98. So you've been doing this for over two decades. What are the tells of the winemaker who truly loves their vintage versus the ones who are not trying to lie, but are trying to put on a brave face? Is there certain sentences, facial quirks? You've been doing this a long time. It's also almost like being at a poker table. Is there any certain tells that you see?
I like the term miracle vintage. I like that one. That means this was not going well, but along came a couple of weeks in late fall and things ripened up beautifully. And,
yes,
it's the miracle vintage. That's a tell to me. Or, you know, obviously when people say it could have been a lot worse, but the miracle vintage to me means, okay, here we go. What's going to be good about the miracle vintage? Well, that we have a vintage at all is good.
Yeah, no, that is a good line. It's like when someone says it is what it is, that means things are bad. No one's ever said it is what it is for something positive. You know, that's never happened. Going back to COVID for a second, you have all these relationships with winemakers and people that work in the field. So how different was viticulture, vinification? How different was that process this year versus, or this past vintage, 2020 versus any other year?
Well, it was the main point of difficulty was they didn't have the workers in the field or on the crush pad that they've had in the past. They just didn't have the migrant workers, the numbers up here. So a lot of that work was done double time by, local people. You know, they just found people from various places, and a lot of them from the restaurant and hospitality industry who weren't working at the time and came out to help. That and the fact that you had to be in a bubble. You had to guarantee to the owner that when you went home, you're not going out with all your pals from all the other wineries and enjoying a nice cold beer on a patio somewhere with a lot of people. And that's hard to do. These are all young people. They're, harvest is a time where you work hard and you celebrate a little bit when you're done. And none of that was happening. So I just think they got down to business, got the job done, and did a really nice job as a team. I think it probably did a lot of team building out there, and way different than previous vintages.
What are some of the biggest differences in Niagara now versus when you started in terms of, for instance, I remember years and years ago, I would see that a lot of wineries would try 17 different varietals. I'm like, why are you doing that? Or many more would try Cabernet Sauvignon. I'm like, why are you doing that? You don't have the climate for it. But I mean, you follow this all the time. I'd be curious to see what are the trends you've seen in changes over the last 20 years.
The biggest change to me is winemakers, growers, finding the right terroir to grow their grapes, and utilizing that and exploiting the incredible vineyards, so single vineyards, noting the differences between, either side of the canal, so Niagara on the Lake versus bench wineries, and not trying things that just don't work. Lessons are learned hard. If we talk about, some lessons you never learn because it's too attractive to chase it. Let's talk about Merlot for a second. Every 10 years, it gets wiped out. We have no old Merlot vines in Niagara. It's very susceptible to cold. It gets wiped out, I would say, at least once every 10 years. Yet, people swear they'll never grow Merlot again. 4 years into that cycle, and they're going, whatever happened to Merlot? I love Merlot. We can sell Merlot, and more Merlot gets planted. But a lot of things, I think, what are the core varietals or varieties in Niagara? I think you and I both know them, like Cab Franc, Riesling, Chardonnay, Pinot.
Yep.
Did I mention Gamay? Gamay is a late bloomer. It's coming on strong. And I think we do fantastic sparkling wines. So the people who concentrate on those grapes are going to have great success. And the people that take it up a notch and find a nice pocket and build those single vineyard wines, those are the ones that I have in my cellar. They're usually single vineyard, special attention paid to them, in the hands of a great winemaker, are going to be superstars, And those are the ones that make you go, yeah, we can compete on the world stage if we do this kind of thing.
And on that, one thing, and I remember it's certainly been a theme on this podcast, is the single vineyard and is more focusing on certain appellations and how if you grow it here, it'll be different than in a different spot. And where are we now with that? Because I joked on Twitter with COVID, I finally learned where the York region was. I had no idea. The joke I made was I could point out where the Wismer vineyards are with much more accuracy than I could tell you the boundaries of York. Again, that's because, that's because who I am. But how much further along are we with that? Because I feel that's one way to get worldwide recognition when it's not some, mono, thoughts about, here's the Pinot Noir in Niagara versus no, here's Foxcroft, here's Wismer, and they can do different things. Where were you now with that?
That's a really broad question and a good one. And I saw your tweet and I was going to respond to it because I think the reference was to Vine Mount Ridge. Was that the sub app you were referencing?
No, it was literally Wismer Vineyard. I probably was cracking open a bottle of Batchelder and I'm like, wait a minute. I know that vineyard. I know where that is. I've driven by there. So I've seen those grapes, but I'm like, York, is that where Canada's Wonderland is? What, you know, it was more making fun of my own ignorance about my own geographical ignorance, and yet my fascination with, you know, terroir specific vineyards in this area.
Well, I think the sub apps are being utilized more and more. We see it more and more on labels now. It means something. It means something to me, and I think it means something to you. If it comes from St. David's, or it comes from Beansville Bench, or comes from Vine Mount Ridge, or 20 Mile Bench, or whatever, 4 Mile Creek, you know, it means something. It tells you something about the grapes. You know, you're going to get a minerally Chardonnay if it says 20 Mile Bench on it. You know, the Riesling is going to have this beautiful personality if it's grown on the Beansville Bench. You know what you're going to, you know, the taste profile. So I think it's important. And not all winemakers buy into it. I know
JP Collat from 13th Street.
Exactly.
We had a big debate. We had a big debate about it. I liked it. I was like, okay, you know, I enjoy the pushback. You know, for him, he wasn't as interested in getting that specific. And I get his point. My sort of broader picture is if that we want to compete on an international stage, one way to do it is to show we have special terroir, because what sells Bordeaux and Burgundy? It's specific special terroir. They're not always, you know, you have to be careful with generalizations, but, you know, if you get a wine from Margaux, it's going to be different than if you get a wine 15 kilometers north from that area.
Totally agree. And I was going to mention JP, because he's dead set against vineyard specific, or
but his Gamays are so good. His Gamays and sparkling are so good.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't like his June vineyard. Anything from there is fantastic. I think it should be on the label, and the sub appellation should be it, because it tells a story, right? I mean, it's as you say, more so in Burgundy than Bordeaux. Let's argue about that a bit. I mean, Bordeaux, it's when you go from you know, Margaux to wherever, Pouillac, or it's a lot of it is the dominant grape, is it not, as opposed to the terroir?
Yeah, like, no, certainly the blend,
if you put five second growth Bordeaux's, if you put five second growth Bordeaux's in front of a fairly knowledgeable Bordeaux lover, are they going to say this is from here and this is from there? Or is this, are they? Unless you can taste that it's Merlot dominant versus Cab Sauv dominant. I don't know. But yeah, in Burgundy, yes.
Yeah, Burgundy certainly more so. With Bordeaux, I was just more bringing that up because, you know, with the Margaux is usually a little bit more perfumed. But, I mean, hell, you could do that with Burgundy, with Chambeau Moussigny versus Chambertin. And, you know, you're going to get, you know, you're going to be able to tell if, you're not always going to get it right, but you can often tell the difference just in those two areas. And, I mean, the bigger picture, again, comes down to what do we want to do in Niagara to be able to, you know, promote these wines, because I'm sure, Rick, you've drank plenty of Pinot and Chard from Niagara, Prince Edward County. You're like, okay, this can compete with, at the very least, high-end Village and even some Premier Cru's, and that these wines can compete, but we sort of have a bit of a chip on our shoulder, you know, about what we produce.
I totally agree. And I think as you know, and I know, it just keeps getting better every year. We haven't even, like, our industry is so young here.
Yeah.
That we're nowhere near the vine age or finding the exact perfect spots for Pinot and Chardonnay. I think Chardonnay is a bit ahead of, like, to me, the Chardonnays in Niagara are world class. I think Pinot is a little behind because it's such a complicated grape to grow and make. And I think there's still trying to find that perfect recipe for Pinot and Negre. The Chardonnays, though, are mind-blowing. In my opinion, it's the best thing that Negre does, Chardonnay, for sure. World-class. You know, I know that there's a little bit of a discussion going on here about, you know, are there Grand Cru vineyards in Niagara for certain types of grapes? That's pretentious as hell. Do we need it? No. But how do you differentiate? You know, I know Thomas Betchold has just gone ahead and started calling his Grand Crus Grand Crus. You know, so he's a proponent of it. Others are dead set against it. I think you know, the general public would freak the fuck out, you know, if somebody claimed their Chardonnay was a Grand Cru Niagara Chardonnay. But, you know, at least the discussion has to start somewhere.
Yeah, well, again, it's a fine line about, you don't want to be pretentious. You don't want to say we're like France, because they've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of a head start on us. You know, there's a reason why those, you know, they had those perfect spots. They had monks 1,000 years ago saying, plant this here, plant that there. So, yeah, you're right. You don't want to look pretentious or get ahead of yourself. But at the same time, you want to properly give credit to why this tastes so good when it's X amount of kilometers away from the QEW or from the canal or from this or that. And I guess it's all about trying to find that balance.
Exactly. And you know, they do it to appeal to their, you know, to fans of their winery. The people who pay $65 for a Chardonnay or whatever, why am I paying $65? Like, tell me a story. Give me more than, you know, it's made by so-and-so. I need more. And that's, I think, yeah, what, you know, winemakers and wineries are trying to do. This is why it costs that. It's because of the land. It's because of the winemakers. Because all of the ingredients. Scarcity, too.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of Chardonnay, I know it's, again, people go to, for you, the focus is Niagara. That's why the website winesinniagara.com. But in your piece on the 2020 vintage, you also mentioned Prince Edward County. I know you were talking with at least Dan Sullivan from Rose Hall Run. What were your impressions? What did you learn about the 2020 vintage in that part of Ontario?
I think it was a little more difficult for Prince Edward County, especially in the beginning. And even in Niagara, it was a little bit chilly, a little bit cold spring. So they were off to a late start and worried about bud damage, which can affect your crop and affect your grapes down the road. But they came through okay and caught up, just because of similar weather to here, like Prince Edward County in the summer can be sort of like Niagara, maybe not as hot. But I think it's a great vintage for what they do best, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
You know, they say it, what Dan Sullivan says, it was excellent in his words. He is a pretty straight shooter, in my opinion. Always tells it like it is. I have high hopes for Prince Edward County, especially their core varieties.
What would you tell people, and especially men? I get this all the time when they say, I'm not going to drink Ontario Reds. They're too light. This is from the Napa Cabernet Sauvignon crowd, which, nothing against, great wine. But people that maybe focus more on that, more on the Brunellos, more the full-bodied 15% alcoholed wines. What would your message be to those people?
Well, as you just referenced, it's not Napa. Napa's very hot. And, you know, if you love those highly extracted, bold, boozy Napa Valley reds, you're not going to find them in Niagara, no matter the vintage. You're just not, it's not going to happen. You're going to find a more balanced approach to the bolder reds. And I'll tell you this, they age beautifully. Like if you find a warm vintage for the Bordeaux varieties, and put them in your cellar for 10, 15, you know, I'm drinking some are 20 years old. They age similarly to Bordeaux. You know, they're virtually undrinkable on release. You go, well, this, I can't drink this. You know, I need a huge, giant, marbly steak to make this even palatable. But you go back to it in 5 years and 10 years, and it's extraordinary. It's amazing how they age. And I was like those people. I did not drink Ontario wines when I first started drinking. Most of it was terrible. I didn't know the little cultish kind of wineries that were doing a great job. And I didn't start learning about Canadian wines until I started writing a wine column and had to have Canadian content. And I soon fell in love with Canadian wines. They're ageable. You know, there are varieties that, as you know, are spectacular, and there are varieties that aren't so spectacular.
All right. For a handy little thing for the listeners, what are some recent vintages that you would tell people to be on the lookout, like in terms of the warmer vintages for people that like, you know, that are into the more Bordeaux-styled reds?
Well, it kind of follows the even years, except 2018, you know, there's some good ones out there, but they were picking between major storms all that year. And so it you really have to try those wines. Like, don't run in and buy a case, try them, try, or go to your favorite winery that you frequent and ask them about it and taste it. So 2020, 2018 with a caveat, 16 was unbelievable, 12 was unbelievable, 10, unbelievable. Then you get a 7 in there, and going from there, 2002 was beautiful, and 98. That's how I look at the bold red vintages, as being the ones to cellar and the ones that I'm still drinking today.
Was there you said you weren't big into Canadian wines, Niagara wines, till you started drinking it. Did you have a moment? Was there a wine, a winery, an experience, that a specific one, or is it just you woke up one day and you said to yourself, Rick, there's a lot of good stuff here, and I've been enjoying it this last X amount of days, weeks, months?
Well, Matt, I started writing, the first wine column I ever wrote was way back in 1999. When I hired myself as the wine writer at the Calgary Sun, because I was a Sunday editor, and I could do that. So my first foray.
Good staffing there.
I know. Is that, it was a form of nepotism, but I'm not sure. And so my first Canadian wine trip was to the Okanagan Valley. It was it wasn't that far. We used to take our kids there. And so I started really getting into Canadian wines in the Okanagan Valley. And I just said, like, my God, why have I not tried these wines before? And so we would go back. I would write about them from time to time in the Calgary Sun. And then the column expanded further into all the other suns. And back then the big company was Vincor, and they would take wine writers, of which I was one of a handful in Canada. And they take you to Niagara, or they take you to the Okanagan on a junket, and started getting into the Ontario wines, and again, I was blown away by at least the ones that I saw. I didn't see all of them in the early days, but the ones that I saw, the Vincor properties and some of the others, Lake Clos was just getting planted at the time. So that's how I got into it. And I was frankly amazed. I was like everybody else. You know, my only relationship with Canadian wines was what my dad used to put on the table, like Chateau Gay and, all the wines that our parents drank.
Yeah.
And they were dreadful, of course.
Yes, they were. My mom, the line would be Chateau Don River, you know, or Chateau Welland Canal, or things like that. Rick, before we end this, for people listening, is there certain wines, wineries here in Niagara that that you would recommend that people should be trying? I don't know if you want to break it down into some good value ones, the wines you would recommend to splurge a little bit more on for a special occasion. Really, wherever you want to go with this, just any suggestions for people?
Yeah, you know, I don't like to just single out a few, but what I suggest is find your style of wine that you like and seek out those wineries who make that style. For the, you know, if you like a bold red, maybe the Bordeaux varietals, Niagara on the Lake's a little bit warmer. They concentrate more on that style of wine. If you like minerally finessed, layered, textured whites, you might go more to the bench wineries. I think Riesling is another variety I think is world-class in Niagara. Everybody makes a nice Riesling. Some make incredible Rieslings. And those are usually found in single vineyards and not just on the bench. Niagara on the Lake or St. David's have some nice personable Rieslings with some minerality. I think you need that minerality. It's what defines Niagara Rieslings, in my opinion. So look for on the label a vineyard or a sub-appellation at least, instead of one that just says Niagara, which just means they took grapes from this side of the canal, that wherever they could buy grapes. So I look for sub-apps, winery and vineyard when I go wine shopping.
Rick, where can people find your work?
Winesinniagara.com is my website. I long ago gave up freelancing, and that's the only place I put my stuff. And I have some good writers on the team who get paid, by the way. So that's where you can find me.
Nice. Well, Rick, I really appreciate you doing this. I saw the article about the vintage of you know, one of the greatest vintages ever, and I wanted to pick your brain, and I really appreciate you taking the time. And again, it's a region we both love, and as I say over and over, I'm not pushing this region just because of some sort of nationalism or some sort of chip on the shoulder. Oh, why can't we be as good as them, whoever them is? I push it because these are really great wines. These are wines that, if you listen to this in Southern Ontario, they're easier to access. We're trying to drink more local anyway, but these are just great wines that if you're a wine lover, no matter where you are, you just shouldn't ignore Niagara because it's not as famous as other parts of the world.
I totally agree. Thanks for having me on, Matt.
Absolutely. Really Thanks so much. It. Thanks, Rick. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.